It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferretz. Today on the show, we're hearing from the two Democratic candidates running to become the state's next lieutenant governor. They face off in a primary election next week. The winner will go on to face Republican Rebecca Clayfish, who doesn't face a primary opponent. Before the news, we talked with State Senator John Lehman. With us now is Mary Jo Walters. She's a political activist and a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. She joins us from our studio in Eau Claire. Mary Jo Walters, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, start off, why are you running for lieutenant governor of Wisconsin?
Aren't you supposed to ask me why am I in Eau Claire?
We'll get to that in a bit. But make the case, sir, why am I running for
lieutenant governor? I should be able to answer this because I've been running for lieutenant governor since March. I'm running for lieutenant governor because no one else was. There was only one candidate running. And at the time, before I decided to become a candidate for lieutenant governor, I was actually running for governor. And at that point, I was running against Scott Walker and Mary Burke. And it was becoming contentious, in a way that it was divisive within the communities that I'm a part of, because we still have that divide of people who are supporting Mary Burke and those that are not, but are all against Scott Walker. And so I decided, after talking to my mom and another friend, to run for lieutenant governor because there was only one person, John Lehman, running.
Well, tell us some about your background and what led you into politics.
I was a class officer in ninth grade, which is not something I take lightly. I had to decide to run for office and then solicit votes and then win. And the reason I did that was because I wanted to have some changes within my junior high school that were not happening, more social activities and things like that. And I was able to do that. And then when I was in high school, I also ran for vice president of my class. And again, I was able to organize events and help with the graduation. I decided politics for me didn't really sort of take off until after I occupied the Capitol for 3 weeks straight. And it was at that point that I sort of saw a disconnect with the people that were protesting and the people that were in office. And I realized then, this is interesting. Why aren't there more activists running for office? And then Chris Taylor, who is in my neighborhood where I live on the east side of Madison, she came out of that energy out of the Capitol and she ran. And also Lori Compass, she stepped up and tried to run against one of the Fitzgerald brothers. And so there was this sort of peak moment of activism in the area. And I sort of was feeding off that. And I also was a part of the Occupy movement. And all that politicization of around issues in and around our state capitol, just really, well, that was just fuel for me.
And what was it about Act 10 that led you to get involved in occupying the capitol and then beyond that into politics?
Act 10 disrupted my child's schooling in that his teachers didn't go to school one day. And neither did the office workers in the school. And so we proceeded to join them at the Capitol. I wanted my son to see where his teacher was. And I continued to go back to the Capitol. And so what I learned was that not everybody was there at the Capitol. There were a lot of people who were not coming and protesting. And so I was with a small group of people holding a family space that those people had set up. But I was a space holder. And that was a motto that I just continued to say, not everyone is here. Not everyone is comfortable coming through, especially after the Capitol started closing down and having a strong police presence. And so I continued to realize at that point it wasn't just about the teachers, even though they galvanized us to the space and they sacrificed quite a bit. It was also they were coming after our health care. They were coming after women's rights. They were coming after the environment. And so I just never left the Capitol after February of 2011.
You mentioned that you're based in Madison. You're in Eau Claire now. You're actually on a bike tour of the state, I understand. Can you talk about how you've been trying to get your name out there on the road?
Um, I it's kind of fun. I decided to be the Mary on a bike that people want. You know, when you travel by bike, you're, first of all, you're going to see things, of course, that you wouldn't see by car. You know, if you walked, you'd see even more. As I biked from Madison to Eau Claire County, I finished yesterday, actually, the ride. I flyered along the way. I've been flyering consistently since I started gathering my signatures back in April. I gathered almost 1,900 signatures by myself to get on the ballot. I had one person, Dave Peters, help me. But anyway, I continue to just do that, which is flyering as I meet people and letting them know there's an election. My campaign, which is also similar to other people's campaigns that are unrecognized by the larger media, we are actually a galvanizing force around talking about participating in voting before the November election. And so that's what I've been doing. I've been meeting a lot of people in gas stations and stopping in at libraries and restaurants, of course, along the way.
And you're running kind of a bare bones campaign financially. That plays into another issue you've talked about, some getting money out of politics. What do you want to see change when it comes to money in politics?
Well, as far as the money goes, I mean, to be realistic, you do need money. I actually spent $800 up until July. So that's from January till July. And to the people that don't have money, the homeless people thought that I spent too much. And I actually thought I did, too. Like $500 probably would have been fine. But when you start to travel by car, you have gas expenses, food, of course, and printing. I spend a lot of money on printing my flyers. I don't have any staff, but those are my main costs, like gas and printing. Anyway, money out of politics means maybe we need more public forums, access to public airways, access to newspapers. I want the move to amend people who are arguing at the federal level and organizing locally to organize candidate forums, because the more you learn that the Koch brothers will be backing candidates, when you call those candidates into a room with the other Koch-supported Koch brothers and whomever money-supported candidates, you put them all in the room together and you have the public surrounding them and questioning them, you're going to have a much more transparent process. And that's what I'm talking about with money out of politics.
You're running as a Democrat. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin doesn't have your name on the webpage as a candidate, only John Lehman's. What is your relationship with the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, it's hurtful, I have to say. It's very hurtful on my end. I'm not sure if it's hurtful on their end. I don't know why they insisted on pre-endorsing John Lehman and Mary Burke back in April before we even had ballot access. I mean Brett Hulsey, but the treatment that I'm receiving from the larger party committee is no different than many candidates that are outside of the chosen few that are selected in the party politics. And I'm not so sure what they're afraid of, but I just moved on. You know what I mean? Like I was pulled from their website. I was on their website. I was pulled from the website. It does hurt me to be blacklisted and not known. I have to try, you know, three times as hard to get my name out there. But more than that, it damages the party because it is an open primary. And Robert La Follette fought for that. And why would you close it down? And I'm going to say this because I'm getting very angry talking about it. I'm going to say this to the Democratic Party and I'm going to say this to the Republican Party. You know, I'm running for an election right now. And when Tuesday's done, I will proceed on many levels to get rid of the primary in this state or at least revamp it. Because if you want to run your primaries, do it in your convention, but don't make the taxpayers pay for this. And then tell people to go vote in November. And so I'm going to finish out. What happens is not only did the state DPW or whatever the initials of DPW, anyway, what it is, they told the county levels, don't work with her. Don't invite her in. She can't come speak at your county events. And they shut me out. And what happens is today I check the Chippewa. I'm in Chippewa County. And I check their website to see what their hours were today. And my name's not listed. I also tabled at the Columbia County Democratic table. My name was not listed. They're lying to people of Wisconsin. They're lying to them. And when they say that there's not another candidate, we're talking about two candidates. It's a primary.
We're talking with Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate Mary Jo Walters. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for the candidate, wondering where she stands on a particular issue? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. Rob Ferret here with Jean Purcell, talking with Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate Mary Jo Walters. She's one of two Democratic candidates on the ballot in next week's primary election for the office. If you have a question for Mary Jo Walters, wondering where she stands on a certain issue, you can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. I wanted to get into a couple of particular issues with you. First of all, you've talked some about a minimum wage during the campaign. What would you like to see change?
Well, with the minimum wage, there are different organizations that are asking for a 10-10 increase in the minimum wage. And then there are others that are asking for a $15 an hour wage. And they're actually coming together on that, meaning like with Seattle, eventually working up to the 15 an hour, but starting at the 10-10. I think that's a good solution. I also strongly fought for keeping the current wage that's in Milwaukee County and Madison County. And on many issues, I think that where you can't find the solution at the state level, you might want to just start at the local level.
If you were elected as lieutenant governor, you would be elected as a Democrat, likely working with a Republican legislature. Do you think you'd be able to work with them to try to negotiate an increase in the minimum wage?
I'm not sure. There's like 300 some candidates right now. I have no idea their whereabouts in terms of on this issue. I guess what we could do is, well, the first thing, of course, would be sort of see if there's an existing, I know the Democrats have proposed a 10-10 law, so I would have to start there and see which Republicans signed on to that. I think that would be a starting point.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Philip on the line in Fish Creek. Philip, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Philip?
I was just curious what her stance would be on Native American rights in the state of Wisconsin.
Can you be more specific?
Vis-a-vis gaming, education, and any other issues that have to deal with reservations.
Oh, so specific to the reservation, what I as a state officer would think or help with, or is that what you mean?
Yes.
Well, I think that, you know, the different tribes have their own governance, and I think that our state would, of course, have to have discussions in and around different issues. I'm not clear on education. Are you thinking about funding? I'm sorry, that's just not something I have thought about.
All right, looks like we've lost.
He's gone.
Yep,
okay, well,
Philip.
I guess I could just blather on.
Well, actually, a related issue that I was hoping to get into is the iron mine in northern Wisconsin. I think that is an issue you've talked some about.
I've not only talked about it, I've screamed about it. I'm opposed to the iron ore mine for sure, and I'm not going to waver on that like Mary Burke did. You know, the thing that really frustrates me is that why can Mary Burke get away with that? How does she, as a gubernatorial candidate, not make a stance on the mine? I mean, I'm against it. I will tell you that. It's a sensitive area. It should be a national park, the Pinoki Mines area. The Pinoki Mines is a bad idea. And so I support the Bad River Tribe as they continue at the federal level to fight that mine. And I don't agree with John Layman that it's just going to be the Army Corps that's going to stop it.
In a similar vein, we've seen a boom in frac sand mining in Wisconsin, especially the western part of the state. Would you pursue more regulation on that industry?
I this is another issue and why I went on the bike ride. The reason I took my bike through and across the Driftless area and then now into Eau Claire County is to actually see the frac sand mines up close, because when I'm in Madison, I'm just hearing about them. And I've seen movies, but I've never seen them up close. Regulation is all we have right now. And there are no air quality standards at the federal level that then the DNR can use. There are local groups that are going to have to start to do this and pay for it themselves. Silica dust is in and around these mines, transporting into people's homes and into their lungs. And so I'm not afraid to say I think there should be a moratorium that shuts these mines down until more studies are done. And probably you can have that last a while, because what's happening is, yes, there's job creation, but there's also at a cost, too high a cost, and that's the health cost of those workers and those that live around in the environment itself.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Andy on the line in Madison. Andy, hi. You're on the air.
I had a question. I'd like to know a little bit more about what your policy or what your position would be on corporate taxation and taxation on smaller businesses. I think there was a caller that called in earlier, Cudahy, that was giving Mr. Layman a hard time about this issue. And, I see Governor Walker's policy benefiting large corporations but not doing much for small businesses as far as tax breaks and things like that. So I'm curious how you stand on those issues.
Andy, thanks for the call. So taxation, especially as it affects small businesses versus larger corporations, he's asking.
I was on the road, of course, this whole week, and so I've had many discussions about many issues, and this did come up. One person was talking about taxations in terms of that definition of what a small business is. A lot of times, a small business is numbered at 500 employees or less. And so what that person was saying, which I would agree with, especially when I'm in these smaller areas, is that maybe, we should have sort of a scale that sort of moderates what number we're talking about here, because small business could be five or less. And so I know that a lot of people that were relating this issue to I'm going to go back to the tribal gaming, which is that, basically you exist on this land and you have this gaming happening or you have this business happening, and the state then says you are taxed for that. And so what I've heard in terms of the gaming is that the gaming brings in business for the surrounding area. And so maybe there should be a different tax rate for that in consideration of that, not just fully taking the money from the gaming at a flat rate, but considering how much money is also brought into the community because of it. I would probably say that would be true for small businesses.
Andy, thanks for the call. Running a little low on time, but Leslie in Amberg is on the line and wonders about your stance on marijuana legalization.
I am pro legalization of marijuana. As a lieutenant governor, I mean, if there's one thing I'd really like to start out with would be to help Melissa Sargent's efforts and to just go ahead and start a task force looking at the legalization of marijuana in terms of dispensaries, the taxation, and the regulation of it, because a lot of people are leaving the state because they cannot get their medicine.
Any other, just a little time left, any other key social issues you'd fight for in Wisconsin outside of economic things like minimum wage and mining?
Something we didn't talk about was affordable housing. I'm coming out of the Occupy movement, and I myself am having a difficult time finding housing in Madison. And I think that we should most certainly, definitely have a task force about housing, because a lot of effort over the last 4 years was put toward, not toward tenant rights, but more toward realtors and landlords. And in Madison, it's pretty skyrocketing in terms of the cost of living there and of her rentals. So I would like to do a survey of what we have available and start talking about some affordable housing projects statewide. We have not done this in decades.
Mary Jo, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, I had a good time. I'm nervous. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. That's Mary Jo Walters. She's a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. Her primary opponent is John Lehman. We talked to him earlier in the show. If you missed any of this week's candidate forums, or you want to hear them again, or check out a whole lot of information about the primary election next Tuesday, you can head on over to wisconsinvote.org.
I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell.
There's been some growing concern about the way antibiotics are used in livestock here in the United States and how often the medications are used in livestock feed, even for healthy animals.
This week, the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group and some area doctors called upon the federal government to add new restrictions on antibiotic use. Carol Spiegel joins us now in the studio. She is Professor Emerita of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UW-Madison. And Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I want to start out with some background here for people who might not understand how antibiotics are used in the livestock industry. I think most people, when they think antibiotics, they think, well, the animal's got, you know, a virus of some kind, so they're going to get an antibiotic. But as I understand it, they are used for much more than that.
That's correct. In the large farms that have thousands of animals, they use antibiotics in the animal feed it's for two reasons. One is that presumably animals that are given low doses of antibiotics grow more quickly, and so they come to market faster. And the other reason is that the animals are so crowded together that they transmit infectious diseases to one another, so they're more likely to get ill. So they're really being prophylaxed. They're being given antibiotics to prevent them from getting infections.
And so the big problem with this, as I understand it, is that obviously then animals become meat. The meat is ingested by humans, and then some of that resistance to antibiotics winds up in human populations.
Correct. It's the bacteria that live in the intestine of the farm animals. Those organisms are exposed to the antibiotics, and antibiotics, especially when they're low dose antibiotics, will select for antibiotic resistant organisms that are already present in the intestine. So the antibiotics aren't causing resistance; they're random mutations to resistance. But it's a matter of survival of the fittest. So the organisms that have randomly mutated to resistance are the ones that can survive in the intestine in the presence of the antibiotics. And they become the predominant organism because the susceptible ones are killed off. And then those organisms, the feces, contaminates the environment. Farmers are found to have much higher rates of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in their feces, as are their family members. And then the stool can contaminate the meat, and the meat can get into the marketplace. And then we consumers ingest it and then get sick with organisms that are very difficult to treat because they're resistant to many of the antibiotics that are routinely used.
Yeah, and we're hearing a lot more about that these days. Do we have any idea of what role antibiotics in animals plays? Is that just part of the picture, or is there more to it than that?
Well, that's the main issue here. It's that the antibiotics that are being fed to the animals select for resistance, and then we have what we call MDR, multi-drug resistant organisms, so that they get into the food supply, get into the humans, and then cause infection in people.
So this week, as I mentioned, Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group is calling for new restrictions on antibiotic use in livestock. What exactly are you calling for?
We're calling upon the Obama administration to immediately eliminate antibiotics from the animal feed used on factory farms and allow use of the antibiotics only to treat sick animals and those animals exposed to other sick animals. So basically just for treatment of sick animals, not for routine inclusion in animal feed.
Now, last year, the FDA has acknowledged, as I understand it, that this is an issue. This idea of antibiotics being used in livestock posing a threat to humans is an issue. They have issued voluntary guidelines that were put in place, I think, last year. And in reading their website, it says that they believe this is the fastest and most efficient way to get results from the industry and from everybody else involved. What's wrong with the voluntary guidelines?
Well, voluntary guidelines are voluntary. So if they don't want to follow the guidelines, they don't have to. And it's important that this be that the change in procedure be used by everybody, because this is a huge issue.
What are other countries doing? I know in Denmark there was a big there was a law passed, I think around 2000, maybe earlier than that actually, that banned the use of, and if you look at the industry, for example, they will point to Denmark and they will say, look at what Denmark did. They banned the use of antibiotics in their animals and it's not working out well. I don't know what the flip side of that is. And again, that's the industry perspective. What is the situation in other countries, and can the U.S. learn from other countries? Maybe it's Denmark, maybe it's another country somewhere where they've already taken some steps or have not taken some steps.
The European Union has banned antibiotics from animal feed. So, and that was done, I believe, back in the 70s. It's been a long time ago that they realized that this was a public health issue and took action. There is a lot of publications out of Denmark where they've banned antibiotics and found that in fact the animals don't lose weight. They continue to gain weight at the expected rate, even the same, very similar to what they were when they were on antibiotics. Some were concerned that if you don't have the antibiotics in the animal feed, that then the animals will get infected more frequently and you'll be using just as much antibiotic treating sick animals. And they found that actually that's not the case, that the animals aren't getting sick more often. So there's a tremendous savings in exposure to antibiotics. There are other countries too. Italy has done some studies, I believe, and Germany has also restricted the use of antibiotics. And some of these countries have found they've looked for resistant bacteria before and after elimination of the antibiotics and seen tremendous drops in the frequency of antibiotic resistance. So if you take the antibiotics away, then the normal organisms, the endogenous flora that were susceptible to antibiotics, will become predominant again. And so you're able to regain the utility of these antibiotics that for a while were not usable.
So you've made the request of the Obama administration. What is the process moving forward? Is it just go into a big silence someplace, or is there some actual action that's going to be taken here?
I don't know. I mean, the FDA is aware that this is an issue, and that's why they put the mm-hmm. voluntary guidelines in place. Whether they'll make a stronger statement or not, I don't know. The CDC has made strong statements about needing to make these changes. It's supported by the American Medical Association, by the Infectious Diseases Society of America, by the American Society for Microbiology. All of those groups are being very outspoken about the need to make this change for public safety.
So let me ask you a question. Let's say that the administration drags its feet, the guidelines remain voluntary, and 5 years or 10 years, we're back in the studio having this same conversation. What are the implications of doing nothing?
Well, organisms are becoming more and more resistant, and I've been in laboratory medicine, which is clinical laboratory work. I've been in laboratory medicine since 1970. And back then, we had organisms like Streptococcus pneumoniae, that is referred to as pneumococcus. They were all susceptible to penicillin. We never saw penicillin resistance. If it was penicillin resistant, we knew it wasn't a pneumococcus. We knew it was some other organism. Now, penicillin resistance in pneumococcus is not uncommon at all. And that's an organism that causes pneumonia. It's the most common cause of bacterial pneumonia, especially in children and the elderly. And it's one of the most common causes of meningitis, especially in children. So we used to be able to treat meningitis with penicillin, which is an inexpensive and, you know, relatively non-toxic drug. And now we often have to use more expensive drugs that sometimes have more toxicity. So, you know, we're, as organisms become more resistant, we have fewer and fewer choices, and the choices are more expensive and more toxic. There are some organisms, like Enterococcus, has become resistant to vancomycin. So they're called VRE, vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus. And sometimes there are no drugs left that can be used to treat those. So we're getting to the point where we're going to have untreatable infections and what's being sometimes referred to as the post-antibiotic era. There was the pre-antibiotic era, and some have referred to it now as the post-antibiotic era, where we won't have antibiotics that can be used to treat infections.
Now, is this something, as I understand it, this is something that's happening relatively quickly?
Yes. Well, if you, yes. Bacteria, there are random mutations to resistance about one every million organisms, and there are 10 million organisms in every ounce of feces. So you got a lot of organisms and a lot of chances for resistance. The antibiotics in feed are low dose, and so that's the optimum way to select for resistance that will increase increased resistance over time, is by using low-dose antibiotics. So we're doing the best possible thing to develop resistance, which is not what we want to do.
So since you've released this request, have you heard from the industry? The industry will tell you that, you know, the guidelines they go by are FDA approved, and it's been proven safe for use in humans and so on and so forth. Have they reached out to you to respond in any way, or?
Not to me. I'm not aware of whether they've reached out to Wisberg or any other group. I mean, in the press, they're saying that they don't think it's necessary, but I don't know any specific interaction.
All right. And so we will see where it goes from there. Carol, okay. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking with Carol Spiegel, a professor emerita of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell.
From campus enrollment to election readiness, it's time for our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. WPR News Director Michael Leland joins us. Michael, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start some news, kind of still developing today, some more of those John Doe documents. What do we got so far?
Right. These started coming out late this morning. The Milwaukee County Executive's Office released documents from the first John Doe investigation. That's the one that involved former aides and associates of Scott Walker back when he was the Milwaukee County Executive. A couple of months ago, a judge ordered the release of those documents. They had been taken by prosecutors from Milwaukee County employees and computers.
And just bringing things up to date, we've got an investigation that was going. It's on hold because of a judge, but then there are lawsuits from some of the political groups involved against the prosecutors. And is that what ultimately set the dominoes in motion to get these documents
out?
Pretty much.
This is all part of that. And this is back from the investigation that was actually officially closed, I think, in about 2013. And of course, as you know, that first one triggered the second one. Mm-hmm. But today's release is from that first investigation. It's 14 gigabytes of documents. So a lot of documents.
That's more than it's going to fit on my floppy disk.
A lot more than the floppy disk. It's things like Word documents and PDFs and spreadsheets, as well as pictures and Word documents that were stored on various employees' computers. Email accounts, though, are not part of this round of release.
Well, I guess I know what state government reporters are doing this weekend.
Absolutely. They are looking over these documents. Our Sean Johnson is poring over them right now up at the state capitol. Reporters from other organizations looking at them all day, and that work's going to continue for a while. And of course, we'll get updates from WPR News this afternoon as we learn more in this afternoon and in the weeks ahead.
All right. Potentially a treasure trove, potentially not. We'll
exactly.
See what comes out of that. Well, turning to some education news, saw some headlines, a big enrollment at the applications at UW-Madison this year.
Right. A couple of education stories. As you mentioned, the first one involving applications. UW-Madison got a record number of applications for this year's fall freshman class. That's more than 30,000 came in. It's about 2.5% more than last year. Now, we don't know how large the freshman class will be. It's not going to be 30,000. For example, this past year, it was about 6,300. UW-Madison does say it did admit about 72% of the Wisconsin residents who applied for this fall, though.
That's the Madison campus of the UW system. How is the rest of the system doing?
Right. If you look around the rest of the system, it's not quite as good. I mean, applications were up a couple of percentage points in Platteville. They were about the same at Stevens Point. But as you look at the rest of the 13 four-year schools in the UW system, applications were actually down. Superior, Whitewater, La Crosse down about 1 or 2%. Applications to River Falls down about 10%. And at UW Green Bay, the freshman applications were down 15% this year.
Any thoughts as to why these numbers are going that way?
What we're hearing is, for the most part, it's demographic. There are just fewer high school age seniors than there were just a few years ago because there are fewer people in that age group. One UW system spokesman told us that there were 71,000 high school seniors in 2009. 5 years later, in 2014, there were only about 63,000.
Oh, interesting. So maybe UW-Madison, which gets more out-of-state applications, I imagine, is more insulated from our demographics here in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. High-profile school, and a lot of people want to go to school at UW-Madison.
So around the state, does a lower number of applications mean fewer students walking around campus in the fall?
Not necessarily, because you figure that you know, far more people are going to apply than will be offered admission. And of those who are offered admission, even a smaller number than that actually enroll for the fall. So we'll find out the numbers later this year once the various campuses have their counts. But a spokeswoman at UW Green Bay, where again the applications were down 15%, said that a high percentage of students who were offered admission have enrolled for the fall, so they're not too worried about the decline.
And then there's been a lot of attention on the technical college system in Wisconsin over the last couple of years as part of the state's job efforts. Any news from there?
Yeah, there was some financial aid news that came out this week. We found that about 41,000 people in Wisconsin who were eligible for financial aid through the state's Wisconsin Grants Program were not able to get that money because the program ran out of money this year. That was largely technical college students, about 38,000, as well as about 3,600 UW system students.
And any explanations for why this might be?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Democratic State Senator Jennifer Schilling says it's because Governor Walker and Republicans of the legislature have been cutting aid to higher education. A representative at the Higher Educational Aids Board, that's the group that administers these grants, says the dollars in the grants have really been about the same. It's just that the demand for them is up. More people are wanting to go back to school, especially for the technical colleges. And the AIDS Board is going to ask the legislature for more money in the next session.
Well, earlier this week on Central Time, we previewed a sad anniversary, the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. Can you tell us what went on since then in Wisconsin?
Right. It was the second anniversary of that shooting at Oak Creek. Six people killed early on a Sunday morning. A white supremacist walked into that temple shortly before a morning service and began shooting. He, of course, then killed himself after police wounded him. So Tuesday at the temple, there was a ceremony marking the anniversary. There were prayers offered for the victims and for their families, as well as for the continued healing of the congregation. There's also been some talk of building a museum and an education center at the temple. The design of that would be to honor the victims, but also teach other people about the Sikh faith and how it relates to other faith traditions.
And I think you'd mentioned to me earlier, a couple of police involved in that incident were honored at that ceremony.
Yes, Oak Creek Police Lieutenant Brian Murphy and Officer Sam Lenda got a Congressional Medal of Bravery each. They were among the first officers responding to the temple the morning of that shooting. Murphy was injured in a shootout with the gunman. He was shot more than 10 times, I believe. Wade Michael Page was the gunman's name. Lenda fired the shot that wounded Page, and then, of course, Page killed himself.
Well, looking ahead now, a primary election day coming up here in Wisconsin. We've talked a lot about that here on the network, and we've talked to many of the candidates on the Joy Cardine Show and here on Central Time. What do we need to know come Tuesday?
Well, there are a number of things the government accountability wants you to know. First of all, that you can register to vote on Tuesday if you're not registered yet. You need to have an acceptable proof of residence document with an updated name and address. And this includes things like a Wisconsin driver's license or a state-issued ID or a utility bill from the last 90 days. If you have a paycheck statement with your current name and address on it, that should be okay. There's actually a full list of what kind of documents will pass to allow you to register. You can see that on the GAB website at gab.wi.gov.
And, of course, the voter ID law has made a long, winding journey through the courts. Do we need to show photo ID when we vote on Tuesday?
Nope, not this time. Supreme Court in Wisconsin recently ruled that the voter ID law is constitutional, but there's a separate federal court order that's still blocking it, so that is still on hold. The state attorney general's office says it wants to get that ID law reinstated. It's not going to happen by Tuesday. Not clear whether it's going to happen before November, but the short answer is you will not need to show a photo ID on Tuesday.
And up to pretty recently, the attorney general had hoped to get that in place by this Tuesday, but a court said we're not deciding until well after.
Exactly. At this point, it's up to the federal court whether to lift its order or not.
So that's voting on Tuesday. Do we still have time to vote early, or is it too late to be early?
It's almost too late to be early, and it depends on what kind of early you want to be. Absentee voting, the last day to vote in person at a county clerk's office is today. There may be some county clerk's offices where you can still vote for the rest of the afternoon. Really depends on the individual county hours. But
maybe
today is
first.
The last day. you might want to call ahead, but you can't go in on Saturday, which had been in the case in previous elections in some counties. If you have an actual absentee ballot with you, though, you can still vote. It just needs to be postmarked by Tuesday, Election Day, and your county clerk has to get it in the office by 4 o'clock next Friday afternoon.
Well, and it's not too late to learn about the candidates at wisconsinvote.org. We've got
Absolutely. All
the interviews we did on Central Time, all the stuff you guys in the news department have done. Is
We're
that right?
We're doing things on Wisconsin Public Radio and the news department. Also, interviews that have been on Wisconsin Public Television.
WPT,
So
yeah.
You can learn about the candidates, learn where to vote, learn how to vote. Pretty much one-stop shopping for everything you want to know about Tuesday's election.
All right, Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
As WPR News Director Michael Leland, we round up the top news stories in Wisconsin every Friday at this time. And by the way, Michael, let me know earlier that we are going to bring news breaks through Tuesday night to bring you election results, primary election results as they roll in. So you can check out wisconsinvote.org online and listen to Wisconsin Public Radio Tuesday evening. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.